You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment. From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history, babe.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Jen.
I'm Ginny. And we are the Art History Babes.
So what's everyone been up to? I mean, I feel like this is a momentous occasion. We're back in our alma mater.
Alma town.
Yeah. Alma town.
Alma town. It's the Alma town. Yeah.
Davis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi, Davis.
I know. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Mm.
Took the song out of my mouth.
Stained.
But yeah, it's nice to be back here. I hear the sound of the train in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh yes.
Yeah, that sound of that train made it really difficult for me to sleep today.
Yeah, so just a little bit of a background for our listeners. I still live in Davis because I am painfully rooted in many ways to this town. And so I live in this really interesting little place that's literally feet away from the train tracks. Mm-hmm. And it shakes my whole place. But I love it. I can't sleep without the Union Pacific coming by and shaking my whole house.
Interesting.
So when I move from here,
it's going to be an adjustment for you whenever you move. Yeah.
I need to go move right next to like a freeway.
Okay.
Because I just don't think I'll be able to sleep.
Yeah. See, I don't think that's that weird. I've heard that from a lot of people that live in like cities or live
totally,
in noisy
like the white
places.
Noise. It becomes white noise rather.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
For but Corey earlier, it was not white noise. It was noise.
Well, I live in the quietest, tiniest suburb right now. It's quiet all the time.
Yeah. It's the boondocks.
And I also work in the middle of the night. So after I got off work this morning at 6:30 a.m., I came here to sleep because they're doing some inspections or something at my place.
Oh.
So I came here to try and get some sleep, which I did, but I am unfortunately not used to the sound of the train tracks.
Right.
So just a little sleepy, yeah. But that's okay. Got my Thai iced tea.
It's the best.
Mm-hmm.
I have some cold brew coffee that I should not be drinking, but I cannot help myself.
Wow.
I love that stuff.
It's good.
It is very good. Well, that's a little peek into our current lives.
It's very exciting stuff.
We're just doing so much cool stuff.
Just traveling a lot between the Davis, Sacramento area.
The Bay Area.
And the Bay Area.
We've
seen the many sights of the drive.
We've got the stretch from Sacramento, well, really outside Sacramento,
yeah.
All the way through the Bay covered.
Yeah.
We're just like.
All the time. All the time.
All over the place. Constant. All the time.
Yeah. Almost every weekend is like, I'm going to drive for an hour in one direction.
Yeah, right.
And that's fine. You know what? That's what's really cool about living in Northern California, I think, is that everything is relatively close by that you want to see.
Yeah.
Everything that's above us, I don't care about as far as California goes.
I love Northern California.
Well,
I think it's beautiful.
You're right. Like, Mendocino is amazing.
Yeah. Tahoe.
Fort Bragg.
Well, no, Tahoe's to the east of us.
Yeah. But it's, like, kind of north.
It's east north.
East north? Northeast?
yeah, like, up there where it gets...
Fort Bragg is lovely.
Fort Bragg is lovely. Glass Beach.
I heard about Glass Beach, and I do want to go. All right, you know what?
I
rescind what I said. That was unfair of me to our north California listeners. I apologize.
To be honest, California is an insanely large state.
Enormous.
It is absolutely enormous. Some of my friends that have thought about coming out to visit and stuff, they don't really understand how big California is until they try and map out like all the stuff they want to see.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, like if you're flying into LA, it's going to take you like 9 hours to get to me.
You're not in New Hampshire anymore.
Yeah, right? But we do live in a cool area that there is a lot around. And we're also super lucky because even though the traffic is a nightmare, we have the train.
Ah, yes.
Which a lot of people in the United States don't benefit from train systems like that. Like, we take the train from Sacramento to the Bay very easily, and it's cozy and enjoyable.
You can drink on the train.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's a cool thing.
Although, the East Coast has us beat as far as the trains go, but...
The East Coast is...
They've had more time.
Exactly. It's true. Yeah, we're still pioneers out here. So.
Yeah, but literally everywhere else except for the Upper East Coast don't have train systems like that.
So, they don't need it.
Yeah, they don't have the hourly trains you know, going places.
Right.
Damn, I love living in California and I can't afford it, but...
None of us can.
I'm staying, okay?
Yeah. It's a great state.
Yeah.
Come out and visit us. We'll show you a good time.
Come out and see us sometime.
Today, we are talking about a good friend of the Artistry
Our
Babes.
Good friend.
Marcel Duchamp.
Ah.
Duchamp.
See, you two took a seminar in our first year of grad school that was entirely on Duchamp.
It was amazing.
Yeah. It was our first quarter in grad school. So right out the gate, a whole... Duchampian extravaganza.
It was amazing. It was actually, I mean, definitely one of the most memorable seminars I've ever taken. And it was when Corey and I, pretty much the first time that we met one of the advisors on our theses, because for Corey and I, we had basically the same committee, and which was fine. It was great because we got to have our meetings together, which really made things maybe a little bit more simple for our professors, a little bit more complicated for us, but whatever. And that's when we met our lovely professor, Professor Housefield. If you're out there, we loved your seminar.
It was a great seminar. And Professor Housefield has actually written a book on Duchamp.
It is called Playing with Earth and Sky, Astronomy, Geography, and the Art of Marcel Duchamp. So this is the baby of our professor, our dear professor, James Housefield. Look it up. It's super, super interesting. Marcel Duchamp, among other things, was interested in physics and astronomy and geography and everything, and we're gonna get into that, but take a look at this book. Take a look, it's in a book.
Reading Housefield.
Oh man, so this seminar was really fun, and we kind of, I mean, I had heard of Marcel Duchamp before, but I don't think I ever really appreciated him as an individual. I just always sort of lumped him in with Dada and cubism. We'd all sort of heard of Nude Descending a Staircase, number 2, very famous work. Even if you're not familiar with what it looks like, most people that are familiar with art recognize the title, Nude Descending a Staircase. So what we did learn in this seminar was that it's not Duchamp. So
when I was in that seminar, I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and I was like, yeah, I wrote this paper on Duchamp, and he started calling him Duchamp. Duchamp. I was like, that's good. I like it.
The first day of our seminar, our professor made us pronounce this name many times, and he said, think of it as the bray of a donkey. And then he started going Duchamp, and it just went on for so long,
for a very long time, until we were like all doing it. He was really waiting.
He was
for
like,
all
you have
us
to do it.
And we were like, ah, Duchamp.
I would love to have seen the faces of people walking in the hallway hearing,
I wish I had been
this,
one of those,
yeah, hearing
the
this
hallway.
Whole class being just very loud screaming Duchamp.
Oh my goodness.
So Duchamp, full name Henri Robert Marcel Duchamp. That's a good name.
It's a good name. Full. It's a full name.
It's a full name. It's a good, strong name.
Yes.
So let's get into a little bit of the nitty gritty on this man.
So just some basics for you. Born July 28th, 1887. He was the fourth of 7 children. Marcel, his 2 older brothers, and his younger sister all became artists. His grandfather, Emile Frederic Nicole, was a bit of a hotshot artist. He was kind of a big deal. In 1904, Duchamp joins his brothers in Paris, who were already practicing artists there. His brother, Gaston Duchamp, which is a great name.
Oh, man.
I don't know why he changed it.
Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, right?
Gaston.
Right? I've never...
No one paints like Gaston.
I can't think of another Gaston. Like, that's a legit name.
Gas for short.
Gasty?
old gassy.
I'm a 14-year-old boy.
But Gaston Duchamp changed his name to Jacques Villon.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's kind of nice, too.
It is nice, but I
it's not Gaston.
And Raymond Duchamp added the Villon onto his name. So mm-hmm. he became Raymond Duchamp Villon.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both dominant figures in the pre-war Cubist group.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in Paris doing that whole Cubist thing. Duchamp's family belonged to a class of what has been termed provincial notables.
Oh.
Right. That were characterized as prudent, honest, logical, down to earth, concerned with efficiency, resourceful, and had a controlled and sly sense of humor.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah. So very.
Wow.
Kind of logical, grounded people.
Yes.
He grew up Catholic, which shines through in some of his work.
Truly.
He plays with that later on. In his early years, he was very interested in comics and cartoons, and he had a love of wordplay that is incorporated into his work for the duration of his career. I mean, it's really fun because he was multilingual, so he plays with words in lots of different languages in a way you have to be really smart to decipher.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
He was a smart man, that rascal.
He was a rascal.
Yeah.
He was a very important voice in the Dada movement, which is a widely diverse art movement. But if you're unfamiliar, it was kind of all about asking questions and making fun of society in some ways. Is
right.
Highly, highly, highly conceptual. As we talked about when we did our episode on A Piece of Work and mm-hmm. they look at mm-hmm. Duchamp's bicycle wheel, mm-hmm. I think Hannibal Buress nails it when he says, like, he was kind of trolling. Dada artists were kind of trolling society.
They were.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even the name Dada was fallen upon because of its simplistic, almost baby
right.
words.
Like Dada.
Dada. And that was entirely done in order to sort of deflate this idea of the high society academic art
right.
world.
Right.
And so this is like the extreme opposite. I think it would be fun to talk about Dada in a
oh, yes.
full episode.
Oh, we definitely will.
We should That's definitely
That's
do that.
That's a necessary one.
Oh, it's like really fun to talk about. But anyway.
So Duchamp coined the term ready-mades, which is a art term you may be familiar with or you may have heard and not really known what it means. But in the art world, a ready-made is a work of art made from a manufactured object. And I think it's important to note a mostly unaltered manufactured mm-hmm. object.
Yes.
It's ready-made. So you can't just take a manufactured object and then turn it into something completely new and crazy. Then it's not really a ready-made anymore. But he was the first to really do this, and he caused a lot of uproar because of it.
Right. Yes.
Some of his infamous works that were ready-mades include In Advance of a Broken Arm in 1915, which I love that title.
It's such a good title.
It is a good title, and it's basically just a snow shovel hanging from the ceiling. It's a snow shovel. He didn't, like, handcraft it. He bought it. He argued that the artistry was behind the choosing of the object.
Mm-hmm.
So he chose the object.
Right.
That was the artistry, not the actual crafting of it.
Right.
Which was a super revolutionary idea.
Incredibly.
And
so.
A lot of people didn't buy it.
Right.
I think a lot of people still don't
oh,
buy
yeah.
it.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. I remember yeah. being at the MoMA 2 years ago, and there are a decent amount of Duchamp ready-mades at the New York MoMA. And there were just people in the room that were mad. They were like, for real? This is literally
yeah.
a wheel. It's a bicycle wheel.
It makes a lot of people mad.
I
yeah.
know,
angry.
Okay, so I appreciate emotional reactions to anything.
Certainly.
I'm a
yeah.
very emotional person. That's how I approach the world. So I can appreciate I appreciate emotional reactions, even if they're angry, because it does mean you give a shit, you know, like you're feeling something, so you care. However, I feel like that's so common with art, is just to jump to anger. And I wish people would be like, okay, I'm angry. Yeah. Maybe I should stop and think about it for just like a second.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times once people learn more about it, they still might not dig it, but the anger kind of
right.
down a little bit.
I think that a lot of that initial anger is really because it's a blow to your ego. When you are confronted with something and you feel like you're being duped, or someone's telling you, oh, you just don't get it. Mm-hmm. That makes people feel insecure and react angrily, because it's hurting your ego, because you're going, this isn't a museum and I'm not getting it.
Yeah.
This is making me mad. I feel like I'm being tricked right now. And I think that's that's a big part of the way that people react to a lot of modern and contemporary art.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you definitely nailed it. People don't like feeling dumb, I guess. And the thing is, if you don't get it, that doesn't make you dumb. None of us got it at first either, you know?
I did not.
I think it's very rare that someone encounters their first Duchampian work and they're like, oh, I know exactly what this is about. That doesn't happen very often.
No.
Yeah. Basically, I think what I'm trying to say is, when you approach an artwork that makes you feel uncomfortable, just remind yourself you're not alone. It took everyone time to work through these things and to figure it out.
And
and that's kind of part of the fun. Hey.
That's a lot of the point.
I'm just going to just come out and put myself on the spot. There are still some times where I'm looking at a ready-made by Duchamp right now. I'm looking at Fountain.
Oh,
which
Fountain.
We will discuss here in a second. Mm-hmm. Fountain was the first work by Duchamp that I've ever encountered. And I just remember thinking, what a joker.
What a smoker?
Yeah, what a midnight toker.
Dude, tell me about it.
Because honestly, that's why Marcel Duchamp was a rascal, okay?
Yes.
This is a huge joke. And I still think of it that way. I think that a lot of the lofty sort of explanations behind some of this stuff is a bit much.
Yeah.
But I mean, I still like it, and I still take it and appreciate it for what it is, and that someone had these thoughts. But at the same time, I'm like, this is a joke. And he thought it was a joke, too.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think the thing with Duchamp is he was very, very smart. And so his work is worth picking apart in these crazy specific ways, because he was very intentional about his work and he did hide things in a lot of his work. And so it's worth analyzing like that. But he also had a very sly sense of humor. And so you have to recognize that there is some element of his work that is a joke.
Yeah.
But like, that's part of it. That's like part of the whole thing. That being said, I don't think that's all he was doing. I think it was kind of
definitely not
a mix of things. I think this is kind of putting me on the spot, because in a sense, I was being trolled, most likely. The first time I think I saw Fountain, like, my instinct was to like appreciate the aesthetics of this urinal, like, turned upside down.
Right.
The smoothness. I went straight for appreciating aesthetics, which I guess isn't necessarily a bad thing, because appreciating aesthetics of any object is a good thing.
Well, let's talk about Fountain, because I think that a lot of our listeners want to know what we think about this work, because it's literally a urinal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that is what it is.
You walk into the gallery and you see this white urinal. And it's turned to its side, and it is very nice. It's a nice urinal.
Oh, it's pristine.
It's pristine. It really is. It's a well-made object, and it is also inscribed on the edge with the pseudonym R. Mutt. So Duchamp signed it R. Mutt.
R. Mutt.
And gave it the name Fountain. So this was a work that he submitted to an exhibit on Fifth Avenue, and his patron, Walter Ahrensberg, he was also a collector, was with him and said, okay, I guess I will buy this standard white porcelain urinal, and I guess we're going to put it in this show. He did not put his name in the show. They didn't know right. who R. Mutt was. The original has since disappeared, so there's 17 copies. Does the SF MoMA still have fountain? One of the fountains?
I think they do.
I haven't been in a little bit, so I'm not sure.
I saw they have a gold one.
They do.
Yeah.
Yes, they
Who
do.
Did the gold one?
That was
it was a female artist.
Yes. They have a couple fountains. One is a gold one by a female artist whose name I cannot remember. I know. I feel like we talked about it
on the podcast before.
I'll look into that. We can do like a little side note for sources on this or something. But they definitely have some fountains.
Yeah. And that's something to note, too, is that fountain resulted in a lot of work
replicas.
Based on fountains. Yeah. Lots of replicas, mm-hmm. lots of people mm-hmm. taking the idea and then kind of adding onto it.
Right.
There's so many works.
Totally.
That came from fountain.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind that Duchamp submitted fountain in an exhibition by a group of artists in New York City called Society of Independent Artists. So this was 1917, and this society had very strict rules, and one of the rules explicitly stated that all works that were submitted would be exhibited. So what a perfect set right. of circumstances for Duchamp to yep. say, all right, I'm going to submit this urinal.
I'm
going to
make you regret that decision.
Exactly. And so obviously they broke the rules because it was only on display for a short while. And the organizing committee was just outraged and mm-hmm. they rejected it and removed it. So I think that the notoriety, though, just completely gave him this sort of up in the New York art scene.
Totally.
We started with the ready-mades, but why don't we talk a little bit about what Duchamp was up to before he headed to New York? Because as we mentioned earlier, he had a background in Cubism.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
His brothers and himself were interested in Cubism. So Cubism in a turn of the century, France, specifically these sort of rural areas that they moved to, there were these small artist communities mm-hmm. that these folk would migrate to and sort of just have a lot of philosophical conversations. And so if you listen to our Cubist episode, we have discussed how many of these artists were interested in the fourth dimension.
The fourth dimension.
Woo! Trying to really isolate something that is, we can't perceive it visually, but attempting to nevertheless represent it in these works. And so because of this sort of obsession with the fourth dimension, a lot of Duchamp's Cubist works are a little bit different than other work by Cubists because you're still somewhat seeing like representational figures in a lot of his work. One of the ones that I really enjoy is, and it's not quite Cubist, but it was made around this time, was, and by saying it's not quite Cubist, it's just there's some kind of rejection to call it a purely Cubist work. We're talking right now about New Descending a Staircase number 2. Mm-hmm. So Cubist, yes, I consider it Cubist, mm-hmm. but I've read a lot of arguments against. And so what's really being represented is this act of movement. Mm-hmm. So it was in these transient moments of movement that Duchamp really found his niche within the Cubist circle, and specifically mm-hmm. trying to isolate this idea of the fourth dimension. And so he would make a number of works that were in this sort of same vein of trying to capture transitional liminal spaces. Mm-hmm. So we love that word.
What did Duchamp refer to? He had a word for liminal spaces. Do you remember? The infrathin.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
We used that word a lot.
We did use that word a lot.
The seminar.
The theory of the infra-thin, it was described by Duchamp as the possible, implying the becoming. The passage from one to the other takes place in the infra-thin. So
essentially liminal
space. A liminal space, right. The notion of becoming and not quite capturing what was before or what's after. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, where a little bit of his Catholic background comes in, especially his work, Passage from Virgin to Bride. Oh. So this work was a follow-up to 1912. He created a work called Just Bride. And in this second work, it was also painted in 1912. Passage from Virgin to Bride is capturing this moment supposedly in which the virgin is deflowered. And so this like very sort of taboo, scandalous moment that is never actually represented. Mm-hmm. So when we think about marriage,
yeah,
we all know the white dress, she's pure. Yes. And then, you know, you consummate the marriage, but you don't see it. And then now she's a bride. So that work is not so much cubist as it becomes almost a mechanical diagram. We'll post pictures, but when you see this work, it looks kind of like a machine. It looks sort of like an engine a little bit. It's got these components that look almost like gears. And then it almost has an anatomy. There's a great word that one of the sources for this paper that I wrote in the seminar uses. And they call her a female mechanomorph. Very cool. It's a creature made of shapes based on mechanical forms. Mechanomorph. And so all of this culminates in one of his most famous works, The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelor's Even, otherwise known as The Large Glass.
Mm-hmm.
1915 was when Marcel Duchamp began to work on The Large Glass, and it was relatively sort of put together by a series of works that he had already made. So it was not only The Bride from 1912, the painting, but also a work from 1914 called Chocolate Grinder Number 2, and then another work from 1915 called The Nine Malic Molds. So these works by Duchamp can almost be thought of as schematics for this machine that was ultimately going to be The Large Glass. There's two parts to The Large Glass. There's a top and the bottom. And at the bottom is something that he referred to as the bachelor apparatus. And it just looks like a bunch of weird sort of like a machine. So he's thinking of this male domain as the machine, with this idea that this machine is attempting to break into what is the bride's domain, which is above. And if you see the top part of this work, the bride's domain is sort of this more cerebral, floaty space. There's sort of like a cloud with three squares in it. So this is supposed to be the more elevated space. And this bachelor apparatus is attempting to break into this top part. And there's this machine that's supposed to be trying to get in there. And it's called the bachelor's boxing match mechanism. So I'm not going to go totally crazy trying to describe this work to you because it is insane. And he talked about it for so long after he had already finished it. Essentially, what you're seeing here, though, is this moving away from the two-dimensional canvas.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of his works are very complex. There's no way we can cover them all here. And that one, I think, is a big one. There's so many elements of it. And there's been so much written on it as well. Mm-hmm. So you can look more into that. What year did he do that? 1915, you said?
He started it in 1915 and he stopped working on it in 1923, but he never really considered it to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to jump back in time a little bit to 1913, but first I think we should take a quick break.
Break.
Break. Break.
As podcasters, we understand the importance of quality sound. Studio headphones are stylish and sleek with proper sound quality.
If you like on-ear headphones, you know, the ones that make you look like a DJ, you'll love the Regent. With 24 plus hours of active battery life and 20 days of standby life, the Regent is the perfect companion to you at home or on the go.
If you're looking for headphones to meet your more athletic lifestyle, check out the Tray. With 9 plus hours of active battery life and 10 days of standby life, made out of sweat-proof material and has custom wing tips that stay comfortably in your ear no matter how you're moving.
These are only two of the many styles that Studio has to offer, so go to studio.com to check them out. Studio emphasizes the modern Scandinavian design while also providing a product that matches the quality of even the highest rated headphones on the market for a fraction of the cost. And they provide free worldwide shipping. Use the discount code BABES to get 15% off any purchase. Go check them out. They're beautiful.
All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about a fun thing called chance aesthetics, which is what I wrote my paper on for the Duchamp seminar that we took. It's just an idea that grabbed me. I really liked the whole idea, and Duchamp played with what are considered chance aesthetics in a lot of his work. So the idea of chance aesthetics is a work of art happens mostly by chance, that mm-hmm. it's actually the chance that creates the aesthetic aspect and not the artist themselves. The artist just kind of controls the atmosphere, but the chance creates the aesthetic.
Gotcha.
Which is kind of contradictory by nature because aesthetics, it depends on your view of aesthetics, but as an artist, some people define artists as someone who creates something aesthetically pleasing.
Right.
So if an artist is giving their aesthetic agency to chance forces, mm-hmm. like, are they still an artist? I don't know. Something to think about. So it's a complicated idea, and there, as you can imagine, there are a lot of people that have a lot of thoughts on chance aesthetics, and since Duchamp, there have been a lot of artists that work with chance aesthetics just throughout modern art and contemporary art. His most notable work where he employed chance aesthetics was entitled Three Standard Stoppages in 1913. With Three Standard Stoppages, Duchamp brought the role that chance plays in the production of an artwork to the front of things. So once again, he's just messing with people's minds.
Right.
He's like trying to mix things up. He's being a little rascal. And so he wanted to bring this role that chance plays in an artwork to the forefront and then use that as a platform to discuss how natural factors dictate reality, mm-hmm. essentially, both art and reality. Mm-hmm. So in Three Standard Stoppages, Duchamp has said this is the ready-made he loved most.
Oh, yeah. Didn't know that.
Which is interesting because I think this is much different than Fountain or the Broken Arm one.
Can you explain really quick how it's a ready-made? Because I didn't know he considered this one a ready-made.
I think he considers it a ready-made because he didn't actually construct anything. Well, I mean, he constructed things after the fact, but the actual artwork. Okay, so the actual artwork, what he did was he took 3 meter long pieces of string, mm-hmm. and he dropped them, and then whatever configuration they resulted in, that was the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the ready-made aspect is probably just the fact that it's just string, you know? Mm-hmm. He just took a piece of string. And
yeah.
But I agree, it's very different from his other ready-made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he considered it one. In fact, the one he loved most. So maybe that was a troll. Maybe he was playing with us there.
Yeah.
You can't trust anything this guy says.
God damn it. Duchamp, we just want to know.
We just want to know. But okay, so he took 3 meter long string. He dropped them and then they each landed in a certain configuration. And then what he did was he cut out pieces of wood that represented that resulting configuration. And the idea was that he was trying to redefine the meter. He was trying to redefine what a meter was. Because if you have 1 meter of string and you drop it
and it's in a different shape, it's still 1 meter of string. Mm-hmm. But then you cut it out in wood and it's not necessarily technically a meter, but is it though?
Jesus.
That like hurt my head a little bit.
That's why I love this work so much. He really wants you to think about reality and mm-hmm. about the way we define things yeah. and the way we make sense of our reality. So chance aesthetics, and the work really changes depending on how it's displayed. It's been displayed in so many ways. So the image we'll have up, there's this box, and then there's two of the meter sticks, quote unquote, that have been cut out that are in the box. And then above the box, there is a black piece of cardboard with one of the strings adhered to it.
Yeah.
And then the resulting meter stick above it. And I picked this one because I think it's an aesthetically pleasing way to show the work.
Mm-hmm.
But the work has been shown in many, many, many yeah. different ways. A lot of times the box isn't even there. And it changes the whole aesthetic of what you're looking at depending on how it is shown. As Duchamp stated during an interview, my first accidental experience that we commonly call chance happened with the three stoppages, and as I said before, was a great experience. The idea of letting a piece of thread fall on a canvas was accidental, but from this accident came a carefully planned work. So in other words, Duchamp involved himself in this contradictory relationship mm-hmm. between aesthetics and chance. So he prefigured a chance experiment.
Right.
So you have to determine how much you think he yeah. was in control or not. Because you can't say he wasn't in any control, but you also can't say.
Right.
This also relates to the concept of the infrathin we were just talking about. To Duchamp, the creative act in these experiments exists in the infrathin, in that moment of mm-hmm. falling that he has no control over.
Right.
So in that moment, that is the infrathin, that is the liminal space, and mm-hmm. that's where the creativity happens.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I do too. Additionally, it is an interesting work because there's some fun things with wordplay going on here.
Indeed.
So the word chance itself is derived from the Latin word cadere, C-A-D-E-R-E, which means to fall.
Mm-hmm.
So just a falling of the strings
yeah.
was chance. So there's Whoa. An interesting...
Do you think he knew that?
Oh, yeah. I guarantee he knew
that. Oh,
yes.
Duh.
Yeah. And also, the phrase bonne chance is French for good luck. Aww. And chance
yep.
equates to yeah. luck. There is mm-hmm. inherently an aspect of luck in chance aesthetics.
Yes.
So this is a multi-layered work. I like the experimental nature of this mm-hmm. work. I like that there's totally. A process to it and that he's actually creating almost like a science experiment in a weird way.
Yeah.
There's like some theoretical physics going on here, you know, which is fun. So yeah, this is probably one of my favorite works by him. In my paper, what I did was talked about it in relation to a work that was created recently as an homage to Duchamp.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Lawrence, with the aid of two digital media agencies, Syzygy and Unique, created Human Tide, a large-scale collaborative reimagining of three standard stoppages. And it's super complex and beautiful. We will have a Ooh. Link to the video on our sources, and you all need to watch it. I really, really love this work. And yeah, it happened in 2013. And on YouTube, it's only got like 6,000 views, and it deserves many more views than that. I think it's something.
Yeah. Let's get up those views. Hey, someone go watch it 6,000 more times.
I just feel like it's one of those things. The people who planned it put so much thought and work into it, and it's yeah. beautiful, and no one really knows about it. And
yeah.
So go watch it. But it was created for the I Am Not Dead Festival in Herne Bay in southeast England, the location where Duchamp created the idea for three standard stoppages in the summer of 1913.
Hmm.
So he was in Herne Bay. He was doing these experiments.
Whoa.
That's where they did this homage.
Gotcha.
The idea for the project came from one of Duchamp's sketches. While three standard stoppages attempts to capture ideas of chance in the physical form of three 1 meter long threads, Human Tide attempted to capture chance in the form of three 1 kilometer long walks of light on film. Now, that probably sounds really, like, abstract.
It does.
And I remember you showing this in seminar.
Yeah.
And it is so amazing. It's you guys really have to cool. see it.
And I don't really know how to explain it better than that. So it's a film that is obviously aesthetically worlds different than Three Standard Stoppages.
Right.
But it was created by people with these very long light sticks at sunset walking along this bay. And there's mm-hmm. three different lines and they happen at different times and at different speeds. And they cross over each other. And then they added music to the background. Just this really abstract John Cagey type music.
Gotcha.
Only more ethereal. Yes. It's just really beautiful, you guys. You got to go watch it. But yeah, so the result was 4 100 second long films representing each of the three stoppages on their own and all three stoppages collected together and then kind of overlaid. So they're trying to map the shape of the tide over the course of the sunset.
Yeah.
So yeah, once again, another artwork, another very large scale artwork that was influenced by Duchamp. There has been so much work created in the past century influenced by him that you probably don't even realize is influenced by him.
For real.
We talked about this a little bit on the A Piece of Work episode mm-hmm. 2, I think. He, in so many ways, is one of the papas of modernism. Some of his ideas permeate through all of modern art.
Definitely,
and
yeah.
we don't know him the way we know, like, Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
And conceptually, Duchamp asked a lot more questions than Picasso, in my opinion.
I think that I you're agree. Right about yeah. that. And I think that he did it, and not to bash on my boy Picasso, but I think that there was a little bit less of an ego behind mm-hmm. some of... I feel like when I see Duchamp's work, I feel... like he has this almost childlike wonder of the world.
Yeah.
Like he's so curious about everything. He wants to know about astronomy. He wants to chart geography, time, and mm-hmm. space. He loved this notion of leaving things up to chance and returning very briefly to the large glass. In moving the large glass at one point, it was shattered. Not
yeah,
it didn't
right.
it didn't completely break, but it caused these big mm-hmm. cracks in the glass, and I forget where this happened, but they were shitting themselves basically. Like, this is the worst thing that could have happened. And when he saw it, he loved it.
Yeah,
he just thought
that's so
like
great.
That's great. It's so much better now.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I love this guy. He's so great.
So that's pretty much all I got to say about that.
And that's all I got to say.
It's all I got to say about that. Check out Three Standard Stoppages and Human Tide, both dope. Were you going to talk about fluxus-y things or?
So on that same vein that Duchamp has influenced so much of what we consider to be modern art, briefly just returning to our babe Yoko Ono. Part of what I discussed in my seminar paper, I know we're just talking about our papers, but we're proud of these papers, okay? Like, we worked really hard on them, so a lot...
Should we put our papers as sources? Can we do that?
I don't know. I'm almost like...
Are we sources?
I mean, you guys can.
I think we could, but I don't know. So this whole notion of becoming and this infra-thin concept... where the creative aspect takes place, I feel was a central tenet to a lot of what the Fluxus performance artists were doing.
Definitely.
And I can only think of Yoko Ono cut piece. And in many ways, the same concepts that Duchamp was drawing upon in works like The Bride or Passage from Virgin to Bride. I feel like these concepts are also being questioned and put in the audience's face in the same way with Yoko Ono's cut piece. This idea that the creative aspect of the work is in the action of removing parts of her clothing. So ultimately, the work is the passage of her going from clothed to basically nude. So there's this sort of voyeurism that Duchamp is interested in that also comes into play with works like Cut Piece. In many ways, I think that the Fluxus movement was a little bit of an extension of some of what Dada was all about. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Definitely influenced by it. And interestingly, too, if you just want to trace the history of art and, like I said, trace these modern ideas back to Duchamp. Duchamp influencing Yoko Ono's Cut Piece. Yeah. Yoko Ono's Cut Piece influenced Marina Abramovich.
Mm-hmm.
Marina Abramovich influenced Shia LaBeouf.
Oh, man.
I want to know what he's doing right now.
I have feelings on the works of Shia LaBeouf, and we should probably talk about them at a later date.
We should contact his people. We have should. Our people talk to his people. Our people, aka us.
We are our people. Yeah.
Talk to
We don't have
people.
Other people.
Oh, my God. Watch us have Shia LaBeouf on an episode.
Oh, and hopefully he does some just weird shit. That would be great.
Just
that would
be cool. Screams at us. Come on, do it.
That would be amazing.
I want to just say that without Duchamp, there would be no Shia LaBeouf do it. I'm just going to put that out there.
I think that's you know? Fair. I think yeah. that's fair. Yeah. So Duchamp is where it all started.
Yeah. Dude.
The original Shia LaBeouf.
Oh.
Wow. That is a lot.
That is.
Oh, man.
Before we throw it over to Ginny, did you have anything else you wanted to throw in there?
No, because I feel that I could go on for a long time about Fluxus, and then we're just going to get all
lost
over
the
place.
Save it for the Fluxus episode.
Yeah, and well, we talk about Fluxus a decent amount in our Yoko Ono episode. So if you are listening and you're like, what the heck is Fluxus? Go listen to our Yoko Ono episode, because that is a jewel of an episode.
That was a good one.
I really enjoy that one very much.
A jewel.
All right, so Ginny's going to kind of jump to a lady that
yeah
a fairly unknown lady
really unknown. Have you guys heard of Baroness Elsa?
I've heard the name. Mm-hmm. And I knew, like, I read through this and I was like, oh, I think I've kind of heard of some of these things.
Yeah.
But I was very surprised by a lot.
Yeah.
Of it.
And I mean, it's a good kind of transition from talking about artists that Duchamp really inspired, because Baroness Elsa was very inspired by Duchamp, but also in turn inspired him in many ways because they were contemporaries. So her full name is Baroness Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven.
Whoa!
She was a German-born artist who was known as the first American Dada. Also, she's been dubbed as the mother of Dada. And she came to New York City and primarily worked out of New York, hence, you know, this American Dada title. So she used her body for work in a lot of ways. She would dress herself elaborately. She shaved and decorated her head, which we know Dadas also did. She sculpted and painted as well. And her body of work is extensive. And I really recommend checking her out on her own. She's a really fascinating and eccentric woman. In talking about how Baroness Elsa and Duchamp came together, they met in New York in the early 1900s when European artists were pouring into the States, specifically New York City. And so she was a very intriguing figure. She got arrested multiple times for walking outside naked, and because of her outfits, she was just very out there, very sexually progressive and aggressive, especially for the times. And she was quite taken with Duchamp's lithe French body and nice bone structure.
Wow.
But
he was a very handsome man.
He continued to deny her advances, but they did remain friends. And
Dang.
Drew a lot of inspiration from one another. So the Baroness labeled Duchamp her platonic lover.
Oh, I like that.
I like that. I've got a few.
Like,
of those.
She gave it her best shot. And never got, like,
she
okay.
really tried.
Like, all right.
Yep.
Do we have a picture? I need a picture of this babe.
I don't have one up of her, but if you just look, we can put one up for the episode. But if you just look up Baroness Elsa, she was really something. So she did Whoa. Several things in terms of performance art that were related to Duchamp, one of my favorites is a friend had given her a newspaper clipping of nude descending a staircase. And once she received this, she stripped down naked and in front of a small audience of people, rubbed it all over her naked body, reciting at the end a poem, "Marcel, Marcel, I love you like hell, Marcel."
Wow.
And so this kinetic performance demonstrated here was a spark to what's been called performative Dada influencing the movement at large from this instance. And their work intersected in many ways over the years. She wrote poems about his work, including his painting on glass, which Jen just talked about, the large glass. And she also made portraits of Duchamp. So she really greatly admired him as a person, as well as an artist. And the two often chatted about their work together and were very open about their work in that way. So she had long practiced taking found objects and rendering them new or unfamiliar by removing the previous context of whatever found object she had uncovered. This was done in many ways through placement and positioning. So like you have an object that serves one specific purpose and you rotate it or turn it and then it's something new. And so specifically, she collected found objects from the gutters and objects relating to waste. So Dadaists, in their response to society's imposed norms, acted out against them, focusing on what society would often label like uncivilized or foul. And particularly, I read a really interesting book about Baroness Elsa. It'll be posted on our website, but it's by an author named Irene Gammel. And she makes the point that since toilet training functions as one of the earliest ways of social regulation and social order, Dada's disruption of that social order is perhaps appropriately located in the realm of toilet matter, obscenity, and waste. So the Baroness created a sculpture of an altered bit of plumbing, cheekily titled God, in 1917.
Oh.
Her focus was on human waste and the phallus, exhibited all with humor. Duchamp's fountain, the infamous and famous piece we discussed earlier, is in many ways related to the piece God.
I mean, they sound similar,
right? Like,
they seem to be dealing with very similar ideas.
Similar issues.
Yeah.
Certainly. So here's where it gets interesting, and these are arguments that are posed by Irene Gammel in this book about Baroness Elsa. So our mutt can be Mutter or Mutter, which means mother in German. Our Mutt also suggests Armut in German for poverty, German being the native language of the Baroness. Duchamp wrote in a letter to his sister, quote, "One of my female friends who had adopted the pseudonym Richard Mutt sent me a porcelain urinal as a sculpture. Since there was nothing indecent about it, there was no reason to reject it." Could this female friend have been the Baroness?
Oh.
Author Irene Gammel makes a convincing argument that yes, it very well could have been.
I've heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There are several other theories linking the Baroness to the creation and provenance of the fountain. The author Irene Gammel admits that while concluding evidence is missing to say definitively yes or no, that if there was, as Duchamp himself stated, a female friend who was involved in kind of the idea for Fountain, it most very likely was the Baroness. Baroness Elsa herself never shed light on the issue. She never had any problems with the Fountain. She never said, hey, that's mine, blah, 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 which kind of makes it that much more of a mystery. But she did continue to proclaim an artistic bond with Duchamp while also being critical of certain aspects of his work, not in a mean way, but just a kind of art critical way. What we can say definitively is that the Baroness and Duchamp were artistically linked and both contributed to American Dada, though one obviously has received significantly more attention.
Food for thought. I wonder why that is. Jeez. I wonder if there is some large
food for thought
social construct that could
be
Does it start with a P?
Is that
and end with a Y?
Is that the good old patriarchy?
I think it is. Talking about his, you know, connection with artistic ladies, it reminded me of, he also did a film with experimental filmmaker Maya Deren.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Called The Witch's Cradle, which is fun, and it involves string. and you should watch it. It's on YouTube. We'll put a link up. But Maya Darren is someone we should also do a full episode
definitely
on. Her shit is so cool. Like, she was an experimental filmmaker in like the 20s, 30s, 40s maybe. And she's famous for the film Meshes of the Afternoon, which is also on YouTube and is really good and is just like this cool experimental film. So if you're into film and you are unfamiliar with her, you definitely need to check her out as well. But yeah, the film with Duchamp is really, it's fun. It's very Duchampian. I think it's a very clear mix of their two styles. I think mm-hmm. it's a really good collaboration.
Yeah.
I also want to just briefly mention that we keep using this word Duchampian mm-hmm. and we did not make that word up.
Yeah, that's real.
Like, that's a real word in art historical
oh, yeah.
terminology. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about modern art, most art history folk will know what you mean when you describe something as Duchampian.
The folk yeah. will understand.
And hopefully
you.
Now you will as well.
I hope that you will.
Do we have anything else before listener mail?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have a listener mail from a while back, August, about our boxing episode. Remember that one, guys?
That yes. was a really fun episode.
That was fun. I like doing those weird thematic ones.
Yeah.
I think they, I mean, they jump all over the place, but in a good way. But if you haven't listened to that, we did an Art of Boxing episode a while back, so you should check it out. And we got this email from Chris, and he said, "So, I think, I'm almost positive this podcast was created for me and me alone. I'm an art
It was Chris, you're right. You're on to us.
It's all for you, Chris.
We've just been waiting for you, Chris. We've been waiting for you, Chris.
I'm an art podcaster who boxed and trained MMA in the late 1990s as things were just getting started.
Dang.
I never fought MMA.
Crazy.
I know, right? I never fought MMA at all, but I knew a lot of the first wave of fighters and trainers. Also, I'm an art geek, do my own art podcast, and have worked in an art museum where a couple of Bellows paintings live.
Mm.
So yeah, this felt like one made for me. Yeah, it does kind of sound like we were on the same wavelength as you yeah. with this one, Chris. An important name who sometimes gets mentioned along with the Ashcan School is a wrestler named William Muldoon. He was the greatest wrestler of his day and a trainer of wrestlers and boxers. He was also an accomplished actor, getting better than decent reviews for his turns on the stage, even in complex Shakespearean roles.
Whoa.
He was friendly with many in the arts community and sat for several painters. The physique of the white boxer in both members of this club is remarkably similar to Muldoon, known as the Solid Man.
Whoa.
Dope.
He was also likely the basis for one of the figures in The Wrestlers at the MFA in Boston. My personal interest in MMA and boxing goes way back, but my main love is pro wrestling. My lifetime project...
Oh, man.
My lifetime project is called A Survey of Pro Wrestling Objects in American Museums. And I've started, but it's much bigger than I thought. It includes places you'd expect to find wrestling objects, like the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and the Museum of the Moving Image, and places that were a surprise, such as the hundreds of photos at MoMA and History San Jose, dozens of wrestling programs and photos at the Andy Warhol Museum, and paintings of wrestlers done by Mel Ramos. As to your question about whether or not fighters see it as performance, kinda, and sometimes. There are two main lines of fighters, grinders and showboats.
Yeah, brother.
Oh.
Okay.
I'm a grinder.
I'd probably be a showboat.
What are you, Corey?
I honestly can't tell you. It would depend on the day,
You're a grind boat?
Mm. I'm a grind boat.
Oh,
sometimes I can be very theatrical, but other times, especially if I'm in survival mode,
yeah.
I think I'd be a little bit more of a grinder. So yeah, I'm a grind boat.
That's awesome.
Showboats, and the best example is McGregor.
Dude.
Oh my god.
Maybe I wouldn't be a show. I don't know. Anyways.
Jenny's like, forget it.
You would be like a cute showboat. You would be not like a McGregor showboat.
Yeah.
And also the things that people love about McGregor are like his insane confidence.
He's very over the top.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's why people like him.
I just
still got his ass kicked.
I just can't stand him.
What was he? He's losing his legs.
He's losing his legs like McGregor. Oh, the greatest video of all time.
I know. That video, the bat video, what was the name of it?
If you type in like bat dad, it'll probably come up, but it's a bat trapped in a Irish family's kitchen.
Bat dad.
It's the best thing you'll ever fucking watch.
It's really funny. Showboats, and the best example is McGregor, are all about putting on a good show, and they tend to be exceptionally good fighters who end up holding back in the cage to be more entertaining. And grinders just go out there to get a win. Yeah, I think maybe I would be more of a grinder because I'm super competitive. So I think that's
this is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Corey out here grinding.
A lot of guys will be grinders in the ring and showboats outside, seeing the build-up to matches as a form of performance. That makes sense.
Sure.
Many will point to Muhammad Ali for that.
Yes.
Great.
I can see that.
Episode. Thanks, Chris. That was a really interesting email. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, Chris, that was very informative. Dope. And
thank you, Chris.
I'm glad that you enjoyed the episode. We really enjoyed recording it.
Yeah, we did.
I think that we should do some more thematic works like that in the future because they're fun, they're interesting, and we end up learning about all of this stuff.
Exactly. Like, especially with that one, like, we were all out of our lane. Like,
oh, yes.
None of us know
completely
anything about boxing.
Yeah.
Like, it was just a fun idea we had, and we connected it to something we know a lot about.
Yeah.
So we would like to do more stuff like that. So, I mean, if you have a good idea for another episode like that, email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. You can find us on all the social medias. Reminder, we got merch. We got merch.
Merch.
arthistorybabes.com/merchandise. Please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes, and donate. You also get access to exclusive bonus episodes that we post on our Patreon, and they're really fun. They're the same regular format. Mm-hmm. We swear and everything in them, but they're fun, and they're more specific topics, like just interesting contemporary topics. So being a patron is very beneficial to you. If you become a patron at the $15 level or the $50 level, you also get a t-shirt.
Nice.
So there's that. Lots of benefits for you.
Also, when you sign up on Patreon, you get to watch our super funny thank you video. It's so good.
It's pretty good.
It's probably my favorite thing we've ever done.
You should probably sign up just for that video. So yeah, head over to our Patreon. Please help support us. We really, really appreciate it, and we appreciate you. You can also write us reviews on iTunes. Share us with your friends and family. Is there anything else I can do? Anything?
Just, you know,
just keep being
just
you.
Just keep being you. We love you guys.
Really, we do. We have the best fans.
We
like,
can't do
ridiculous
this without you. And honestly, I think we've said this before, but I really do get emotional when I read these very nice listener emails. If I'm ever feeling down about myself, I just go on there and I'm like, man, everyone loves us. And it's a really good feeling. So keep the listener email coming. We love it. We might just read yours. Thank you for being you.
Yeah. And thanks for being involved in everything. We just had our Halloween costume contest recently.
Yes, that was amazing.
It was amazing. We got so many great submissions, you guys. We were like, holy shit, this is crazy.
You guys are awesome.
You guys are just really awesome.
You really, y'all like did it up.
Yeah,
too.
You brought it. It was a hard decision.
Yeah.
There were so many good ones, so many creative ones. So thank you for everyone who participated. We'll definitely do more contests like that in the future. So thanks, you guys. You're really the best, and we will see you soon.
Have
see
a good
soon
time.
From Cabernet to Mont-Lay, they're here to slay the art history bay.
Marcel, Marcel, I love you like hell, Marcel.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.